And our sermon text today is Job 1:1. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. And that man was blameless and upright, one who feared God and turned away from evil. In college, I took life-saving from my high school swimming coach, Mr. Smith. I should have known better, really. He was a very tough swimming coach, and he put us through our paces in this course, too. I learned to swim in a disciplined fashion. That's still with me today. He taught us proper form, and then we practiced some more until some of us threw up in the pool. He'd tell us almost every lesson. I still remember this so vividly. Started at 7 a.m. in the morning, three times a week in January, slipping into this old YMCA pool that was ill-heated. He would tell us that someday both our lives and the life of a drowning victim would depend upon how well we prepared today. He was old school. He was serious. One of the most serious things he did with us was expect us to wrestle with an impossible foe in the water, a drowning victim bigger and stronger than any of us. After teaching us a few basic life-saving skills in the water, we were expected to save a 260-pound starting lineman from our football team who pretended to be drowning. His nickname was Nails because he was as tough as nails. And he did his best to thwart all of our rescue efforts and drag us down to the bottom of the pool. Good training. Coach Smith would say, even a 90-pound cheerleader has almost superhuman strength when she's drowning and adrenaline is flowing. If you can rescue Nails without drowning yourself, you can rescue anybody. That was his theory. And all nine of us in class, without exception, were dragged down to the bottom of the pool as we began. Nails would mercifully release us before we actually drowned. I still occasionally have a nightmare of, you know, just seeing that chortling look in his eyes in the pool, right, as he's dragging us down. But we learned in a very vivid and personal way what we were up against, trying to save a panicked, adrenaline-infused swimmer. We all felt overwhelmed and challenged when we began the course, but gradually, as our skills improved and our strength grew, we came closer and closer to actually handling Nails in the water. Now, most of us couldn't beat him on dry land with a hand tied behind his back, much less in the water. But our final exam, we had to rescue him. And he fought us hard. But if we persisted in our efforts, he was instructed to relent and let us drag him to the edge of the pool. I passed. I was now a qualified lifeguard. But I was also wiser and humbler. Now, I feel the same way about Job as I did about Nails. I've been wrestling with Job for years, really, ever since I've been in ministry. The book of Job is the equivalent of my college life-saving nemesis, but that's precisely the purpose of the wisdom books, too. That is to strengthen, train, and prepare the young man, especially, to live wisely on the earth. It's meant to be impossibly difficult. So don't be dismayed. So as you move through the book of Job with me, and you think anywhere along the line that you've got it all figured out, you've mastered what it means to be biblically wise, remember Nails. So today we will introduce the book of Job and its major themes and its outline and so forth. You have there on the inside flap of your bulletin a brief outline of that you can help fill in if you want with some notes. But first of all, the title, Job, after the principal character, right? Some posit Job as a fictional character. Traditionally, he's assumed to be a real man who lived in Uz. Uz lay to the east of Canaan and is associated with Edom and Aram. For instance, in Lamentations, Jeremiah says, "Rejoice and be glad, O daughter of Edom, you who dwell in the land of Uz." That being a synonymous parallel, Uz being equated with Edom. And then as we read today in our genealogy, the sons of Aram, Uz, Hul, Gether, and Mash. Aram being to the east, of course, of Canaan. Edom was also renowned for her wisdom. Jeremiah says, a prophecy concerning Edom. Thus says the Lord of hosts, is wisdom no more in Teman? Teman, the capital of Edom. Has counsel perished from the prudent? Has their wisdom vanished? He says in a scornful, sarcastic way. Job was then consequently not an Israelite, but a pious Gentile in the period between Noah and Abraham. That's important to keep in mind. We'll deal with this more extensively in the purpose of Job. Well, the author of the book of Job. Probably multiple authors, that's my stance, with a translation by Solomon. Multiple authors over an extended period of time with a translation finishing then in a translation into Hebrew by Solomon. Now, there are many theories concerning authorship. Moses, Solomon, Ezra, or Nehemiah, perhaps a host of anonymous authors from a spectrum of time periods. My best judgment is multiple authors over a wide expanse of time in the patriarchal period and composed in several languages. It was handed down throughout the Middle East and finally translated by Solomon into Hebrew and incorporated into the canon. Most scholars agree today, including conservative believing ones, that Job went through a number of stages of composition, some as many as 7 different stages. Now, I'm not dogmatic on the various stages. I'm still studying that, and that's not as important as some other things. But I do think it began as a simple narrative parable of Job, as Jesus might have taught, or as any of the prophets might have taught. A simple narrative parable of Job. It began with his sufferings, composed of chapters 1 and 2, setting up the story, and then chapter 42, concluding it with Job's steadfastness and resulting restoration. Then, as godly wisdom began to flourish, other elements were added with the plot thickening, literally. Some see a number of wisdom schools, too, and I'll touch on this as we go through Job. Some see a number of wisdom schools reflected in the voices of Eliphaz, Bildad, Zophar, and Elihu. Then there are several other distinct parts in Job that stand out. Job's lament in chapter 3, the ode to wisdom in chapter 28, it's very much like the ode to wisdom in Proverbs chapter 8, as well as the speeches of God, those majestic speeches of God in chapters 38 to 41. So, this is my understanding as I've looked at this. I've spent 6 months in intensive study of the book of Job. These are my conclusions after examining a whole host of different alternative theories. But as well, the entire book of Job, lock, stock, and barrel, could have also been delivered FedEx from God to Moses, too, for that matter. The dictation school of inspiration is how that is understood. But I think that's rather unlikely. And so you have before you what I've just sketched for you in terms of the author of Job. It's perfectly logical that Job is a kind of composite of godly wisdom by pious men ranging over the period of the patriarchs, from Noah to Abraham. This is the period considered the patriarchal period, the period between Noah and Abraham. Job was handed down through the generations, and then in Solomon's ambitious labors to accumulate wise sayings, it was translated under his kingship into Hebrew. The text is clear that Solomon not only composed a literature of wisdom, but also arranged and sought out existing literatures of wisdom. You remember from our study of Ecclesiastes. That book says, besides being wise, the preacher, i.e. Solomon, also taught the people knowledge, weighing and studying and arranging many proverbs with great care. That is, those not necessarily composed by him. Weighing and studying and arranging many proverbs with great care, i.e. Job. The preacher sought to find words of delight. So he was a searcher then for words of delight, not necessarily composed by himself. And uprightly he wrote words of truth. So Solomon not only composed himself proverbs and works of wisdom, but also sought out others, i.e. Job, and then translated it into Hebrew. It's my conviction that Job circulated for centuries in Israel and surrounding countries as a book of wisdom in one or more languages, Ugaritic, Aramaic, Arabic, and Syriac. We derive many of the understandings of the vocabulary of Job, for instance, from these languages. And then upon Solomon's initiative and direction, it was translated into Hebrew. It also explains another knotty problem that every student of Job encounters. That is, it's impossible grammar and vocabulary. So one of the things that keeps you from looking at this book for very long, it's impossible grammar and vocabulary. For example, be in prayer for me, please, because Job has over 100 vocabulary words found nowhere else. And that doesn't mean just nowhere else in the Bible, but nowhere else. How do you possibly ascertain with absolute certainty meanings of such words? For example, you take a minute to turn over to Job 6:6, a good example, because it involves food, so it's a good example for me. Job 6:6 says, "Can that which is tasteless be eaten without salt? Or is there any taste in the juice of the mallow?" Now, I love the ESV because they're true to the literalness of this translation, the idea of the juice of the mallow. Now, if you have another translation besides the ESV, you probably have the white of an egg, because almost all other translations have that. Now, the mallow is a succulent marsh plant, doesn't lend itself to eating very well, but the meaning of the word is so obscure, we had to go to the Syriac to get the idea of the juice of the mallow. But that's the closest there is. The idea of the white of an egg, you may have some footnotes there that say the meaning of the Hebrew is obscure, but it's more than just obscure. It's clueless, unknown. Okay. So these are the kind of issues that we're dealing with here when we come to the book of Job. So for me, it's hooray for the ESV in giving us a close parallel in another language. The rabbis, too. I found that the rabbis in a modern translation of Job used the same primitive expression. The mallow's juice is what they call it. Well, that's the issue of the vocabulary, and the grammar is even worse. It is tortuously complex. Now, when you study Hebrew grammar, it is a monument, at least for me, it was a monumental effort to do. So Brian studied a little bit of Hebrew grammar as well, so you know how difficult it can be. But it's even more so in Job, and scholars have long wrestled with why that is. So there's no parallel anywhere else in the Hebrew canon to Job for these things. The best explanation I have found is that an already familiar book in a sister language or sister languages, as Ugaritic and Syriac and Aramaic is, this familiar book in a sister language or languages was rendered into translation Hebrew. That's what we have in Job. Translation Hebrew. That is, Hebrew that retained a substantial amount of the grammar and vocabulary of the original language. It would be familiar to Solomon's contemporaries, but far less so to us these millennia later. So, Job is a product of multiple authors over a long stretch of time, translated and finished in Hebrew by Solomon. The date, of course, we've pretty well established that it's during the period of the patriarchs, the patriarchal period. The purpose of Job, number four. The purpose of Job is to show continuity in redemptive history between Noah and Abraham. To show continuity in redemptive history between Noah and Abraham, the period of the patriarchs. That time between the flood and the calling out of Abraham, when we have a renewal of special revelation and the covenants, the beginning of the covenants again, but there is this long stretch of period, this hundreds of years, maybe thousands of years. Between that time and the period of the patriarchs is covered largely genealogically. We saw this in chapter 10. Genealogically, we get a good sweep of the patriarchal period in Genesis 10 through 11, but not narratively. We don't have a detailed story of the patriarchs in this period, except for that all-important chronicle of the Tower of Babel. That we do have. So, was God on vacation during this time? Was redemptive history on autopilot or pause? God was not saving, calling out a people for his own, perhaps? Of course not. Therefore, Job fills in a lot of gaps in redemptive history. It's one of the themes of this church. You remember, in our membership course, we went over this. A whole lesson dedicated to the idea of redemptive history. That is, God is always saving in every generation, in every period of time. Job helps to fill in some of those gaps. It shows us how redemptive history is nevertheless progressing. God is raising up a seed of the woman who, unlike his first father, Adam, steadfastly clings to his God and his integrity, as Job does. Redemptive history is going on apace. Also, Job shows us that although we have not the full light of Christ revealed to us yet, there is enough light for Job and his generation to be saved. Always, God gives enough light in every generation for everyone to be saved. Many of the themes of Job, too, carry through to every period of redemptive history. We see them consistently. That is the longing for a redeemer. We'll see Job, almost every speech, has a longing for a redeemer. Also for meaning and purpose, for suffering. We also see the theme of the tendency for God's own elect to cling to him steadfastly, no matter what he does to them. One of the questions I posed to Debbie, and she says, aha, is what would God have to do to you for you not to believe in him or not to cling to him, not to have faith in him, not to love him? What would he have to do to you? That's kind of what Job's situation is. And also, of course, the theme of the love of God and his kingdom that he has, the love of God he has for his kingdom. and for his creation. Both that which is of his kingdom, thy kingdom come, thy will be done. There is that longing as well in Job. That kingdom which is and that kingdom which is to come. So, Job is demonstrative proof that redemptive history is going on apace, even in the relatively quiet period between Noah and Abraham. Quiet for us, not so much for Job. But number five, the genre is wisdom. It is wisdom literature through and through. Enough said. Structure and form of Job. It is patriarchal lawsuit. You can fill that in on your space there. It is ancient patriarchal lawsuit. A number of suggestions have been given for the form and structure of Job. Once again, forests of trees and rivers of ink have been spent debating and trying to decide the form and structure of Job. But for my money, the simplest and most comprehensive, and I'll exhaust you in demonstrating this, the simplest and most comprehensive in accounting for all the elements of the book is that of the ancient patriarchal lawsuit. Now, I've been in Job off and on for like 6 months or so, and I was getting pretty desperate there a few weeks ago. Debbie remembers it about the time of Lent. And I didn't have that grip on the theme and the structure and form, that which was driving the book of Job, that which made the book of Job cohere together. Just having trouble finding out, I wasn't satisfied with anything until indeed this came under my purview. The idea of the patriarchal lawsuit. And it was like, Eureka, I found it. And I went cartwheeling through the house, sort of. But Debbie remembers that day. I was ebullient. And just, I finally said, okay, I can preach this now. Because I have the structure and form and that which drives the book of Job. That is the question, doth Job fear God for naught? That's the driving question of Job. Now, the entire narrative begins in the heavenly council of God and his sons, that is, the sons of God, the vast array of the created heavenly beings. We'll be picking this apart a little bit, too, in days to come. And they are there to give periodic account for their actions, these sons of God. God is not making casual conversation when he asks of Satan, from where have you come? He is bringing him to account. And so Job becomes exhibit A of God's redemptive purposes, to which Satan challenges with an accusation, surprise, surprise, which precipitates the action and undermines the redemptive purposes of God if that accusation is sustained. Doth Job fear God for naught? From there on in, a classic patriarchal lawsuit unfolds before our eyes, replete with a formal accusation and indictment, an investigation in the form of a trial by ordeal, the taking of evidence, the taking of testimony by witnesses, that is Job's friends, who end up being witnesses for the prosecution, and then a verdict, an execution of said verdict. So, the actual structure of ancient patriarchal lawsuits has recently come to light. But students of Job have long recognized the formal legal language of much of the book, too. Rabbis in the Talmud, for example, and some of their references become clearer as it becomes clear they understood the ancient patriarchal lawsuit nature of the book of Job. And then the church fathers, too, also recognize these things. For example, chapter 11, if he passes through, as Job is opining, that is, if God passes through and imprisons and summons the court, who can turn him back? And that's precisely what's been going on. in chapter 9, he says, though I am in the right, I cannot answer him. Here's a plea for an audience with God and for a mediator as well. He says, I cannot answer him. I must appeal for mercy to my accuser. If I summoned him and he answered me, I would not believe that he was listening to my voice. Language of the court. And in chapter 23, we'll hear Job saying, there, that is in the judgment seat of God, there an upright man could argue with him, and I would be acquitted forever by my judge. So we'll see this language of the courtroom consistently throughout the book of Job. Structure and form is a patriarchal lawsuit. As Meredith Klein puts it, and he helps illuminate these things, he says, to have a grasp of this matter is to have the key to a satisfactory understanding of the fundamental meaning and message of the book of Job. That's very important to get your mind around. It was what gave me my eureka moment. Finally, so much fell into place, cohered, became a solid picture. To have a grasp of this matter, that is the structure and form of Job as a patriarchal lawsuit, is to have the key to a satisfactory understanding of the fundamental meaning and message of the book of Job. Number 7, you have the outline there, which is a basic, slimmed down model of the ancient patriarchal lawsuit. You'll see elements there. First of all, you have the setting, that is the progress of redemptive history, chapter 1, verses 1 through 8. Then you have the accusation or indictment that Satan gives, verses 9 through 11. Then you have the demand, that is the charge to proceed with a trial. And then you have the investigation, that is a trial by ordeal. This is the way we will investigate the question. Doth Job fear you for naught? Or does anybody then consequently too, by extension, do we fear God for nothing? Then there is an opportunity for a second accusation, which is of course what Satan does. He says, skin for skin, right? God, for a man's skin, for a man's health and strength, he'll do anything. So there is an investigation continued, a trial by ordeal continued, where God is afflicted with a grievous disease. Then G, you have the taking of additional evidence by corroborating witnesses for the prosecution. And that composes the substantial part of the book there, from 2:11 to chapter 37 and 24. And then finally, there's that eloquent, exalted verdict by God with an appeal in the middle, chapters 38 through 42, basically. And then there's the execution of the verdict as well, where his fortunes are restored and three friends make restitution on his behalf and so forth. So there you have the basic outline of the ancient patriarchal lawsuit. Okay, the themes then of Job. A, under 8, you have the themes of Job. There is the central question. The central question which precipitates and drives the entire book. That is, doth Job fear God for naught? Now, as Satan always does, he tweaks and skews his questions, doesn't he? Job does not serve God for naught. God serves him because he is God. We see a majestic, unarguable, overwhelming presence of God throughout the whole book. And Job, as we'll see, serves him for faith and love as well. Job serves him not for naught, but for faith and love, and just because he is who he is. He is the living God, the creator, the sustainer, the redeemer. So, with that understanding of the question, Job does fear God for naught. Contra Rabbi Kushner, for example. He's perhaps one of the most ubiquitous and eloquent of those who argue that the driving question of Job is, why do good people suffer? Why do good men suffer? He wrote a book called When Bad Things Happen to Good People, with Job as his central character in demonstrating this. Now, the problem with this, and what I wrestled with and why I rejected it as the driving question of Job, is because it is anthropocentric, that it is man-centered. It is not God-centered. Satan's question is God-centered. Does Job fear God? The fear of God is the central aspect here. Does Job fear God or not? One author says, Kushner seeks to offer comfort to grieving people. His answer to the philosophical problem is that God does his best and is with people in their suffering, but is not fully able to prevent it. This is not the picture of Job that we have in his book. But Rabbi Kushner appears on Oprah, and suddenly the church adopts his premise and solution. This has been the modern solution for a long, long time. So the central question, doth Job fear God for not, precipitates the trial and all the subsequent action of Job. This question lurks behind every speech and every plot, twist, and turn in the prologue and the epilogue. The question, does Job fear God for naught, assumes that Job does not fear God for nothing, but that he expects to gain something from it. That if he's good and if he's righteous, God will shower him with goodness and good things, prosperity, lots of kids, these kinds of things. And this is Satan's accusation. And it is the presupposition of many of the characters, too. His wife comes up to him right in chapter 2, right? Curse God and die. I.e., God has broken the deal. You've been upright, you've been righteous, you've been good, but he's broken the deal. Now he's made you miserable. Curse him and die. And the idea that Job does fear God for naught, i.e., he does it for love and faith. He does fear God because he is who he is, and he sees who he is, and he loves him, and he has faith in him. That is Job's position. That is the presupposition of James 2, apostolic commentary on Job and his motivations. Once again, I love the ESV. The ESV translates that Greek word as steadfast, not patient. The idea that Job is steadfast through all of this. That is, he's steadfast to his confession, steadfast to his integrity, confesses God as his, and does not curse him and die. Better translation than the patience of Job, the steadfastness of Job. So this question then, the driving question of Job, doth Job fear God for naught, is one that is then finally answered unquestionably, triumphantly, in the affirmative. Job, and by extension, you and I, fear God for naught, quote unquote, i.e., because we love him, we have faith in him, we see him for who he is. He is gloriously God. So, we have then also B then under 8. That is another theme we have, is that of the lex talionis. Get used to that term. You're going to hear it. Latin, lex talionis, meaning the law of retribution. Lex talionis in theology, and don't roll your eyes. Don't go to sleep, because it's a very important principle. The law of retribution is the principle that God blesses on the basis of obedience, and he curses on the basis of disobedience. Good behavior? We do this with our kids all the time, don't we? Good behavior, reward. Bad behavior, punishment. And in general, all other things being equal, this is the magisterial principle of God's justice, isn't it? Once again, that's an important qualifier, all other things being equal. But all other things being equal, in general, this is the magisterial principle of God's justice. Turn to the book of Leviticus, for example. It's the whole reason for the pronouncements of Israel on Mount Gerizim and Mount Ebal, right? Stand on Mount Gerizim and pronounce blessings for obedience. Stand on Mount Ebal and pronounce curses for disobedience. Very simple. Even a child can understand it. And Leviticus 26 is a good summary of those curses, meant to be a reprise of it. Where Leviticus 26, if you walk in my statutes and observe my commandments and do them, then I will give you your rains in their season, and the land shall yield its increase, and the trees of the field shall yield their fruit. And he goes on through the early verses of 26. But then in verse 14, he says, but if you will not listen to me and will not do these commandments, if you spurn my statutes, if your soul abhors my rules, so that you will not do all my commandments, but break my covenant, then I will do this to you. I will visit you with panic, with wasting disease, the fever that consumes the eyes and makes the heart ache. And then he goes on, verse after verse after verse. So, lex talionis, the law of retribution. This, too, is one of the major themes of Job. Also in the New Testament, we see it reprised. It was the presupposition in Romans, if you remember, for God's judgment and God having to pour out his wrath on Christ, for that matter. It is how we will be judged, finally, before God's bar of justice. Whose obedience will stand? Paul says in Galatians 6, God is not mocked, for whatever one sows, that he will also reap. Lex talionis. What you sow, you will reap. Same thing. So, what these guys say, the three friends of his say about lex talionis, the law of retribution, much of it will be true. But you have to ask yourself, is it an ironclad extrapolation or deduction in every case of the sufferer? Is this what Job is undergoing? That's why we say all other things being equal, the law of retribution is true. That brings us to C, the problem, purpose, and premonition of suffering. One of the major themes of Job. It is not the driving question, but it is a major theme. The problem, purpose, and premonition of suffering. Three P's. The problem. There is a problem. A righteous man is suffering. Why? That is Job's theme, isn't it? Why am I suffering? If I could just grab God by the collar and shake him and ask him, why am I suffering? There is always the purpose of suffering, too. There are other purposes for suffering besides a simplistic formula of lex talionis. Other purposes for suffering, which may not be known to the casual observer, right? The casual observer, i.e. his friends. Does anybody, any protagonist at all in Job, finally get to know why Job is suffering? Job himself never knows why he's suffering. There are other reasons. And then there's the premonition of suffering, too. That is, a true intercessor for which Job searches. A true intercessor may well have a purpose for suffering as well, unknown to the casual observer. We just saw, right, in the passion of Christ, in his crucifixion. What did everybody around him think he was suffering for? Huh? Someone else's sin? No. They thought he was suffering for his own sin, for being blasphemous. But there was another purpose for his suffering, unknown to the casual observer. The problem, purpose, and premonition of suffering. There was also the theme in Job D, the quest for an audience with God, or at least a mediator. Job is searching for an audience with God, or at least a mediator between us two. Job says, he's not a man as I am, that I might answer him, that we should come to trial together. See, there's that theme of the patriarchal trial again. He goes on to say, there's no arbiter between us who might lay his hand on us both. Let him take his rod away from me, and let not dread of him terrify me. Then I would speak without fear of him, for I am not so myself. See, that longing, that searching for an audience with God, or at least a mediator. Then E, theme E, there is the transcendent, inscrutable will of God. That's a major theme all through Job. The transcendent, inscrutable will of God. God has a purpose for Job's suffering. It may not seem like it. All of us too. As we suffer, we may ask for a reason, for an audience. But God has a purpose for all suffering. He has a purpose for Job's suffering, which none of the protagonists ever discover. It's never disclosed to any of them. Is God being arbitrary and cruel then, as many would say? No. For Job, for the book of Job, it is essential to the premise of Job that he not know the purpose for his suffering. It's essential to the premise of Job. By keeping it unknown, undisclosed, we therefore keep a sterile laboratory, a sterile environment for Job's motives. If he knew the premise of his suffering, Satan could just turn around and accuse him of riding out the storm so that he might get the blessing at the other end, right? So it's necessary to the premise of Job, the book of Job, that it remain undisclosed and unknown to all the protagonists. And then finally, many of you love to hear that word, huh? Finally. A major motif is creation. Creation in particular man, but also animals and plants and so forth. Creation is an eloquent testimony to the goodness and glory of God. This is finally affirmed in Job, that all of creation, man in particular, is an eloquent testimony to the goodness and glory of God. Somehow in the back and forth of Job, we'll see this. The back and forth of Job and his interlocutors, we see a great panorama of God's creation. We'll see this. Its beauty, its majesty, and its display of God's glory. Especially true of God's verdict speeches, chapters 38 to the end. God's verdict speeches are full of his glory and the glory of creation. So as you move through Job with me, you will see these major themes, and you will see Christ, because Christ is here, and Christ is vivid throughout the pages of the book of Job. And we'll see his glory, and we'll see his the tissue of the text. Just, you can see Christ in it as Job longs indeed for this mediator, for this one who will lay his hand both on God and himself. And Job will be vindicated, even as we see a sufferer, an early sufferer for reasons unknown to the average viewer of the book of Job. Indeed, there will be a redemptive purpose in the entire book of Job. Well, as we ponder these things, then, let us come to that place where we see the suffering of Christ anticipated early in the book of Job, the suffering of Christ reprised in the bread and wine of the supper of the Lord.